Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanant Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. Is your dharma your karma? They are intricately connected. Karma is very, very specific to you. As many people as there are in this room are as many different karmic packages as there are in this room. 7 billion people on the planet, 7 billion karmic packages, which is why 7 billion different lives. Dharma has two components. It has the individual component, but it also has a universal component. While you and I have different individual dharma, there's the universal dharma that's also very important to remember. And the universal dharma is the stuff that we all are supposed to abide by. Remember, I mean, dharma is a very difficult thing to define in English. It's a Sanskrit term that all of the English definitions tend to sort of describe around it. We can do this without actually getting to it. Dharma is that which protects us. The root of the word dharma is that which protects us. Dharma is that which holds us together. Dharma is the righteous way, or the right path. Those are all just different ways of kind of going around it. We also say things like, fire's dharma is to burn. Water's dharma is to be wet. So again, none of these is an exact definition or an exact translation. Each of them kind of takes us around. But what we know is that the right path, that which protects us and holds us together, is things like compassion, integrity, truthfulness, right? You look at your yamas and niyamas. Okay. You could say, these are the 10 commandments of a dharmic path. They happen to be the base of the 8 limbs of yoga as given to us by Patanjali that we call the 5 yamas and the 5 niyamas. But you could absolutely make an argument that these are the 10 commandments of a dharmic life, right? It's the right way to live. We all need to live with nonviolence, we all need to live with honesty. All of these apply to everyone. But then individually, this is where karma and dharma overlap. Individually, we come into this world with our own, as we say, karmic package, and therefore with different dharmas. So, someone's dharma maybe to be a professor. But now a dharma is not a career, and this is actually where it ends up getting really misunderstood a lot these days. A lot of people come in and they'll say, well, I don't know what my dharma is. I'm looking for it. I can't decide whether to be a lawyer or an engineer or a business person. Now, these are career choices. When we talk about someone's dharma of being a teacher, well, they may be a teacher in the career of an engineer. They could be a teacher in the role of a CEO of a company. Dharma is that which, when I perform, it is the nature of who I am. As in, a fire's dharma is to burn, a water's dharma is to be wet, right? We're not just talking about what it does. We're talking about its nature. And this misunderstanding that we've got has made a lot of people not only very confused about it, but it has made people believe that their career is the thing through which they are supposed to be fulfilling their dharma. And that's not always the case. For some, it may be. You could look at the Bhagavad Gita. I keep coming back to it. It's A, a divine scripture, a great example. B, it's what you're studying. So you could say, okay, Arjuna's dharma as a warrior is to fight to uphold the dharma, as in the universal dharma, as in peace and righteousness and goodness and all of that in the kingdom, which is why he needs to fight the battle. You could also say, in some sense, being a warrior was his job or his career, right? I mean, not actually, but yeah, this is what he gets up and does. But that's a rare case. And it's also not the case throughout his whole life, right? I mean, the war was what he did at a certain point. What he did at a different point was serve as rulers of the kingdom. But what he did for a lot of time was run from his evil cousin. All of that was dharma. And people today have this misconception that somehow I'm going to figure it out. Is it my dharma to be a fashion designer? Or is it my dharma to be an engineer? Or is it my dharma to be an actress? Or is it my dharma to... Chances are none of us have come in with that type of... You know, I always say nobody comes into this world with something stamped onto your bottom that says president of the company, or stamp on the bottom that says runway model. We come stamped on the bottom with divine being. What we choose to do is a product of 100 different factors. It's a product of our karma, which has given us the opportunities. Right? Some of us are going to have the opportunity to get an advanced education, right? Some of us have the ability to stay in school, even go to college, get a bachelor's degree, you can get a master's, you get a PhD. Well, you can only do that if you don't have to be chopping rocks on the side of the road to put food on the table. Nobody's going to go for an advanced degree while their children starve that there's no food on the table. So what my career can be is a product of a lot of factors, one of which being my karma, because my karma has determined which family I'm born in, which situation I'm born in. Do I even have the luxury to finish school? Or do I need to go work out in the fields at 9 years old to support the family? This is karma. This is what karma has put me into. But when we talk about dharma, so I'm trying to help you see distinctions. When we talk about dharma, dharma is what is the nature of who I am? I mean, my individual dharma. What is the nature of who I am? That I am put here to do and to be. And that doesn't necessarily mean a career. If I am the one who's chopping stones on the side of the road to feed my family, well, you wouldn't say a stone chopper is my dharma. But my dharma may very well be to be the provider of my family. My dharma may very well be to be the first person in my village whose children have the possibility to finish school because I kept chopping stones on the side of the road to send them to school. So you see the distinction. One is what I'm doing. It's a product of my abilities, my skills, my opportunity, the karmic package I've come in with. It's also a product of how much I apply myself. You may get a job because you had the tenacity to show up every day to remind the boss that you really wanted it, while someone else might have been much more qualified than you were, but was more content to sort of rest on her laurels and wait to hear back from the boss. And it was your tenacity that paid off much more than your ability and skills. So the jobs that we end up with, the careers that we end up with, are not necessarily that which we have to look at as that which is supposed to fulfill my dharma. If my dharma is to be a leader or a teacher, that doesn't necessarily have to be how I pay the bills. Our scriptures are full of stories of people who are incredible. Sages, rishis, at heart and in knowledge and in what they share, what they give, what they do, but who are cobblers or stone workers, low-level workers. Is there a dharma to be a cobbler or an ironsmith? No, the dharma is to share wisdom. Sewing the shoes is what they do to keep food on the table to feed the family. Now, lastly, going back though to the concept of this universal dharma, doing our duty is part of our dharma. So, this is where dharma gets complex. So, sewing the shoes, chopping the rocks on the side of the road, it's not that being the rock chopper is my dharma, being the cobbler is my dharma, but my dharma is to do my duty, which is to take care of my family. And I'm going to do whatever means necessary in order to do it. My dharma may be to be in service of the environment, let's say, okay? So I work for an environmental organization and the job they give me is folding and stuffing envelopes, okay? Maybe they're having a fundraising drive, maybe whatever it is. I come in, I wanna serve, I'm given this task of folding and stuffing envelopes and putting stamps on them. Well, is my dharma to stuff envelopes? Have I really come into this world with the dharmic package of envelope stuffer? No, but my dharma might be to serve the environment. And today it may be envelope stuffer. Tomorrow it might be picketer. Day after it might be letter writer. Next year it might be lobbyist. Who who knows? That's going to keep shifting. So the duty that I have in how I'm fulfilling my dharma is going to change. But if I look at envelope stuffer and say, well, this can't be right. I thought it was right because I wanted to work for the environment, but clearly I'm overqualified to be, you know, licking stamps and sticking them on envelopes. If I'm expecting that to be my dharma, or that to be my way of fulfilling my dharma, and I'm looking at it that narrowly, I'm going to be very frustrated. If I understand that my dharma is to be of service to the environment, and if today what Greenpeace needs me to do is stuff envelopes, that's what I'm going to do. If tomorrow they need me to lobby, and the day after they need me to write a letter, and next week I'm going out on one of their boats, and you know, whatever I'm doing. And who knows? It may be 20 years of doing that and not feeling like I'm making any difference when let's say some news channel, I'm making this up as I go along, but let's say some news channel is doing a story on Greenpeace's work, and because I've been working there for 20 years and this is what I happen to be doing these days, they interview me. And what I share in that interview, the information I give or the inspiration I give ends up creating a domino effect on global policies of what's going on in the oceans or in the forests or with the air. Right now, remember, my dharma was to serve the environment. I had no way of knowing when I was stuffing envelopes that the way that was going to happen was through that which I'd learned over fulfilling so many different roles for them over the 20 years and then having the ability to convey that at the right time, in the right way, in a way that caused that ripple impact. Or instead of it being a TV interview, the, you know, Environmental Protection Agency has got a vacancy and they ask my boss and he says, oh, I've been a great worker. I get sent over there. Now I'm making policy. Now I'm able to effect great change. So there's a million ways for this to happen that we have no idea. And this is why, as Lord Krishna says in the Gita, we just keep doing. We just keep doing our duty. Staying in alignment, having faith that the way is going to be shown to us, that which is supposed to flow is going to flow through us. And all of this, of course, in alignment with our karmic package. For some people, their dharma is going to flow through them in one way. For some, it's going to flow through in a different way. For others, it's going to flow through in a different way. Right? So Arjun's dharma was to be this warrior and restore the dharma. His karmic package included him being born at that time and that war being the one for him to fight. If he were born today, his dharma would be the same. But his karmic package would have been different. And so he would have been fighting that war in a completely different way. Restoring dharma today looks very different than it looked then. We don't use horses so much. We don't use chariots so much. We don't use bows and arrows so much. He'd require a completely different skill set. Dharma is the same. Karmic package and therefore circumstance is different.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. I accept and I believe that I am the reason for my own misery. But how can I unlink myself with it? Okay. So there's a great quotation, and I don't know who says it, but it's one of my favorite quotations, which is, if you are miserable in a room alone, chances are you're the cause. And I love that quotation, and chances are the person who's asked the question has heard me say that or some variation of it, because we always blame others for our misery. I would be in such peace if it weren't for you. I would be so happy if it weren't for you, and you're the reason. I was so great, then you showed up. If you just would act like this or do that or be like this, then I'd be happy, then I'd be peaceful. But what that quote reminds us is, people may do things. People may say things, sure. That's what people do. But if you're sitting in a room and you're miserable and those people aren't there and you've carried what they did or said into that room, you are the cause of your misery. So the question says, okay, I recognize that. I believe you. I know that. But how do I disconnect myself from the misery? This is the problem between what we loosely call conscious mind, unconscious mind. You can go into more depth of it, but there's no need to go into those depths right now. For now, it's enough to just say conscious, unconscious. Conscious mind, thinking mind. If I give you all a math problem to solve, something more difficult than 2 + 2, you're going to have to apply your conscious mind to it. Thinking mind. So when I say to you, you are the cause of your misery, and you walk out and you repeat to yourself, I am the cause of my misery, this is your conscious mind. And it's trying to help you. It's doing its best. It's a good guy. It's telling you every time you're miserable, you're the cause. You're the cause. Sadhviji said, you're the cause of your misery. But now here's the problem. We've got this unconscious mind, and that includes subconscious as well. So what I'm calling unconscious is everything other than the most conscious thinking mind. So we have subconscious, unconscious mind. And this is the place that all of our patterns of behavior lay. This is the stuff that was programmed into us when we were children. This is the stuff that over our lifetimes have become habitual. A scientist named Pavlov did a study many, many years ago that's one of the most fundamental studies in behaviorism and psychology. And what he did was he took dogs and he would ring a bell. And every time he rang the bell, he would give them food. After a little while, at the sound of the bell, the dogs would start to salivate. Like right now, it's almost dinner time. If suddenly from the kitchen, smells of curry start wafting through the door, you're going to find that your mouth gets a little bit wet. It's great. It's God's beautiful plan to help us digest our food. But so we salivate. So these dogs started salivating at the sound of the bell because they knew that bell means I'm getting food. But then he did something very interesting. He stopped giving them food after the bell. They kept salivating. So you have dogs who at the sound of a bell salivate. Now there's no reason for them to salivate. There's no food coming. But at some time in their past, the bell meant food. And it was a learned behavior. Now I bring this in to right now because what happens in our lives, this is what we call subconscious unconscious. Pavlov could have stood there and screamed to the dogs, "No food coming. Kitchen closed." But their mouths would still salivate. Because it wasn't that they would hear the bell and the brain would think, oh, this means food. It wasn't conscious thinking. It had become habit. There's a saying in neurology. They say neurons that fire together wire together. Two things that happen at the same time become connected. If in my childhood, let's say I shared a room with my brother. And every night when my parents turned off the lights, my brother beat me. Well, in my mind, darkness meant pain. Lights went out, I got beat. Well, the neurons in my brain that recognize darkness and the neurons in my brain that respond to fear and pain start wiring together. Now I'm an adult, no brother in my room, no beating, but I'm afraid of the dark. I need a very, very bright nightlight. Why? Because my brain has wired darkness to fear, darkness to pain. Okay? So, not a true story, it's just an example, but like Pavlov's dogs. So what happens in our life is we develop patterns. In our lives, for example, when we were young, some pattern happens. We're taught something by our parents. You're not good enough. You're the ugly one. You're the stupid one. Or we're taught the world is a dangerous place. Our mother's afraid. Our father's afraid. There's anxiety. We pick it up. Maybe nothing ever happened to us, but we were raised by people who were anxious. We pick it up. Now we've got this pattern, like Pavlov's dogs, in our brain. The world is a dangerous place. I'm the stupid one. I'm not worthy. Who knows what our pattern is? But it got into us at a young age. On a brainwave level, the brain waves of children 7 years and younger are pretty much the same types of brainwaves that you have when you've been hypnotized. And I mention this because children are very, very suggestible. What you put in the minds of children, they take. And it stays with them. But this forms the subconscious, unconscious part of our mind. And so if I've been taught at a young age, I'm not worthy. I'm not lovable. Maybe we had parents who every time we cleaned up our room, maybe we had a mom who was stressed, didn't have money for a housekeeper. She was working two jobs. Cleaning the house was the biggest headache of hers. Every time we didn't clean up our room, she got really angry. Every time we did clean up our room, she gave us a big hug and kiss and baked us cookies. Well, in our mind, two things get embedded. Number one, chances are we're going to grow up and be very, very clean, very, very organized, very orderly, and we're going to get distressed if things are out of place. Maybe we have a roommate in college who's really messy, and it creates so much stress for us. It's her stuff, but why can't I sleep? Why does her messy bed bother me so much? And we're not even aware of it. But in our brain, what it signifies is loss of love, loss of love, loss of love, loss of love. And what we learn is love is contingent upon what I do. It's not given based on who I am, based on my existence. It's based on whether my room is clean or not. Did I get good grades? Did I get bad grades? Whatever the thing that our parents, that was important to them was. Acceptance and love is based on what I do, not who I am. And what does that mean? Means I, as a being, am not actually worthy of love. I'm very organized, I'm very orderly, I'm very good in school, I'm a good cook. When mom comes home, I've got dinner on the table. Whatever it was I did, I can do these things and I do good things, but I, as a being, if the room's messy, if I failed math, if I didn't get dinner on the table, didn't go pee in the toilet, you know, whatever the thing was, I'm not worthy of love. Which means at the core of who I am, I'm not worthy of love. And I mention this because that's the cause of misery in our life. And all people around us do is they trigger that. They trigger that. I'm trying to be clean. My roommate is a mess. I'm trying to be organized. My project partner's a mess. And why does it make me so miserable? Because on a deep level, it signifies loss of love. But I can't think my way out of that. That's the dilemma. My conscious thinking mind cannot think my way out of it any more than Pavlov's dogs could think themselves out of salivating. Or I could think myself out of a racing heart in the dark. Could buy all the most expensive locks, hire a guard, put in an alarm system, sleep alone or sleep with a bodyguard, and my heart would still race because I cannot think myself out of that. And this is actually where so many of the other practices, practices of meditation, practices of working with the subconscious are so powerful. Ritual. Yajna, anything that gets you into a state that's not the intellectual thinking mind. This is one of the things that makes rituals so powerful, is they impact us on that level, beyond the thinking mind. And so the only way to unlink ourselves from our misery is not by thinking. It's by actually going down deep into the source of our misery and healing it there.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip or the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. We know that whatever way we are looking for peace, joy, divine connection, light in our lives, whether we call it enlightenment or whether we just say light, we know that stress takes us off it. Now, Pujaswamiji said something very beautiful on the banks of Ganga, and he was speaking about illness. And he said that the greatest illness, the most fundamental illness that we suffer from, is the illness of our thoughts, the illness of what we think. And then he went into the concept of stress management and self-management. Now, most of us, if we go around the room and I say, okay, tell me what stresses you out, most of you would give me an answer about something that a family member does, your spouse, your children, maybe something that your boss does or something that an employee does or something that your colleague does. I'm really fine except when my colleague steals my work, or I'm really fine except when my boss belittles me in public or asks me to do something that's over my head, or I'm fine until my employees can't remember what they're supposed to do, or I'm fine until my husband doesn't appreciate me, or my wife belittles me or insults me, or I'm fine until my children don't do their homework or don't clean up their room or don't eat their dinner. Whatever our thing is, most of us would say that that which causes us stress is something outside. Or I'm fine until I get stuck in traffic on the way home. I've worked all day long. I've got this plan that when I get home, I'm going to do yoga. I'm going to meditate. Maybe I'm going to take a jacuzzi. Maybe I'm going to cook up some good, healthy vegetarian food. But now, instead of getting home in 10 minutes, it's going to be 3 hours till I get home. So whatever our stresses, it's something outside of us. And what ends up happening is today it's one thing, tomorrow it's something else, the day after it's something else. But what we've done, and we speak about this frequently on an emotional and spiritual level, but today I want to take it onto a physical health level as well, is we've hooked our happiness, our peace, into something over which we have no control, something that someone else does. If you dance according to my tune, I'm peaceful. If when I say jump, you say how high, I'm happy. But what we also now know is that stress is actually at the foundation of the vast majority of illnesses these days. Almost everything, even the stuff that we think of as purely physical illnesses, are worsened, heightened by the thoughts in our mind, worsened, heightened by our stress. And so much of it is actually created in stress. We don't have time now to go into all of the biochemistry of it, but it's actually incredibly exciting because what we know is that more important than the DNA sitting in our cell, more important than the DNA sitting in our cell is the environment in which that cell sits. The environment means the blood in which that cell sits, which means that that which floods our bloodstream, our hormones, all the chemicals that's flowing through our blood by what we think, by what's coming, being secreted due to our adrenal glands, by what we eat. That environment, we now know, is actually more important than the DNA sitting in the cells because it's that environment that determines how that DNA is actually going to manifest. Will the genes that you have be expressed or not? Will you actually get the cold or flu that someone has just sneezed or coughed into a room? You're sitting in a room, 20 people are in the room, one person has the flu, they cough, they sneeze. Out of that 20, some are going to walk away scot-free as though the person had never sneezed. Others might get a little bit of something, scratchy throat. But a couple of people are actually going to come down with full-blown flus. And what we know is that that determinant, our immune system, is interacting with our emotions. Again, I don't have time to go into all the science of it, but it's incredibly exciting. We now know that what we thought were just emotional neurotransmitters in our brain are actually talking to, interacting with, impacting the cells of our immune system. So when Pooja Swamiji says self-management instead of stress management, well, what's self-management? It means how can I unhook my happiness, my peace from the world around me? How can I learn to manage myself so that I'm not like the light bulb, as he always says, that somebody else switches on and off? You do what I say, I'm on. You don't do what I say, I'm off. How can I do that? And the way to do that is what we refer to as a spiritual practice. But it doesn't matter what your religion is. It doesn't matter what spiritual path you're on, but a path that takes our antenna. These days, everything's digital, but if you think about what TVs used to look like with antenna that sat on top of the TV, picking up signal, and you imagine that our antenna are focused outside, and if we take those antenna and we focus them inside, so that within myself, my experience of okayness, my experience of enough kindness, because that's actually what causes the stress. If we dissect it, why am I not in peace? Why am I not happy if my kids don't clean their room? Why am I not in peace or not happy when my employers or employees don't do what I want? Well, if you dissect all of that, if you look at all of that which steals our peace, steals our happiness, all of the individual incidents, what they all boil down to is a fear within us that what I want, what I think should happen to me in the world, won't. That my okayness, my enoughness is dependent on that. And when we're able to bring those antenna in, and we're able to actually experience within ourselves the fact that source of peace, that source of joy, that source of enoughness is within. We spoke yesterday about the source of misery being within. Well, the source of the opposite of misery is also within. And this is what the sages and the saints and the rishis of every religion have always told us. If you look at any religion, their mystics, their sages, their prophets, nobody came down and gave teachings that said, in order for your life to be successful, make sure you get together a bunch of employees who will always follow your instructions. In order for your life to be successful, make sure that you never get stuck in a traffic jam. In order for your life to be successful, make sure that your family members always do exactly what you tell them to do. Always appreciate you, always love you, always respect you. Make sure that you're always able to buy the nicest things. Nobody says that. The teachings are all the same. It's all about connection to the divine. Again, whether we experience that divine in the form of a God with a name, without a name, with a form, without a form, whether we experience it just in the form of what you could call spirit or consciousness or love, whether we experience it in trees or rivers, nature, doesn't matter. But when we're able to connect to that, and that's actually why, lastly on this topic, that's actually why things like being in nature are such wonderful, wonderful prescriptions for so much of that which ails us. Because it reconnects us. And so when we actually develop this ability to manage ourselves, it means that which is stealing my peace is my own ego. It is my own desires. It is my own expectations. It is my own filter through which I'm seeing the world. Doesn't mean I'm bad. Doesn't mean I'm wrong. Doesn't mean if I'm sick, I've done something wrong. It just means that what I need to look at for answers is me. That rather than figuring out how to change the world, my path becomes about how can I change the glasses through which I'm seeing the world? How can I change the filter through which I'm moving through the world? I'll end this with my favorite story on the topic, which is the story of this beautiful man, wise man, and he's sitting under a tree in the shade at a crossroads. And a young boy is sitting beside him. And as they're sitting there, a man walks from one direction and comes to the old man and says, "That village up ahead, what are the people like in that village up ahead?" And the old man says, "Well, where are you coming from?" And he says, "Oh, I'm coming from such and such a village." And the old man says, "Well, What were the people like there? And the man says, oh, they were horrible. They were liars. They were cheaters. They were deceitful. They were selfish. And the old man said, I'm so sorry. But that's exactly what the people are like in the village up ahead. And the man thought, oh, God. But of course, where is he going to go? There's only one road, only one village. So depressed, he continues walking. Short while later, another man walks up and says, Baba, what are the people like in the village up ahead? What's the village like? And again, the old man says, well, where are you coming from? What are the people like there? And he says, oh, I'm coming from such and such a village, and the people were just great. They were so loving, so sharing, so kind, so compassionate. And the old man says, well, I have great news for you. The people in the village up ahead are exactly the same. And so the man was very happy and he went along his way. And the young boy says to the old man, he says, but Babaji, how is it possible? There's only one village up ahead. How is it possible that the people of that village are both selfish and lying and cheating and horrible, as you told the first person, and kind and compassionate and loving, as you told the second person? And the old man said, because it's all in how we see them. So someone who has the habit, has the pattern of seeing people as being cheaters and liars and selfish, that's what he's going to find. And someone who has the habit of seeing people as kind and generous and compassionate, that's what he's going to find. And so that's the self-management. How can my eye be attuned in such a way so that I see in the world that which I want? How can I see it? And actually, the very last point I want to mention on this is recent studies that have been done on the power of our thoughts to actually create change in the world outside. We know that our thoughts can change us. We know that if I'm angry, if I'm thinking the right thoughts, I can get myself out of anger. We know that if I'm in the midst of a stressful situation with my own power of thought, I can bring myself out of it. But what we now know is that the power of thought and the power of intention is so strong. And I'm talking about studies being done in America's top universities, not like New Age yoga institutes, but actually research-based top medical scientific institutions, universities, that have now found that our thoughts, even when at a distance from the target, have the power to change that. Whether it's rates at which plants grow, whether it's rates at which seeds germinate, whether it's rates at which immune system cells divide in a petri dish that someone else is holding. There have been an incredible number of studies on this, on the power of our thought and the power of our intention. So when we learn to harness that, when our focus becomes, as Pooja Swamiji said, self-management, then automatically the stress dissipates. And then what we'll find is a lot of the illnesses themselves dissipate or don't come. It's a beautiful inoculation. But even when they do come, doesn't mean you're not going to get bit by a mosquito that has malaria. Doesn't mean you're never going to fall down and break a leg or scratch your arm and bleed. Spirituality is not an inoculation against things like that. But what it means is that the suffering that accompanies those accidents, the suffering that accompanies those ailments, isn't there. And when the suffering isn't there, what we find is that, yeah, the body's the body. It's going to do what the body does. It's going to respond the way the body does. But when we are not mentally suffering with it, A, we heal a lot faster. And B, we don't experience it with suffering. So we're able to still be in peace, in joy, connected, even when the body may be having a challenge. The body may be in recovery. The body may need some extra help. But it becomes just the body, not our entire peace and joy along with it. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on OM Times Radio.